Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Hanif Qureshi, whose latest novel is Something to Tell You. He's the author of, counting this one, 8 novels, among them The Buddha of Suburbia, The Black Album, Gabriel's Gift, The Body, 4 works of nonfiction, 3 plays, several screenplays, including My Beautiful Laundrette, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, and Venus, nominated for Oscars for both Laundrette and Venus. This latest novel concerns a psychiatrist in London with flashbacks into Thatcher's England. I don't know if this was even in your mind. You may not have read the book, but it reminded me in some ways of a book called The Line of Beauty.
I'm aware of that book, which I haven't read. I think you might find that a lot of fiction writers don't necessarily read a lot of fiction because you spend all day, you know, working on these paragraphs. You don't necessarily want to spend all night reading other people's. But I think a lot of us, particularly those of us who have turned 50 recently, as indeed I have, and a dark, hard day that was, have become interested in post-war British history. And when you think of what Britain was like in the 1950s, when I was a kid, when I was growing up, and through the 60s and up to the present, it's pretty interesting to see the complete transformation of your world and your society through the 70s, through punk, through Thatcherism, the 80s, and up to an age, I guess, of something called, or something like, Muslim fundamentalism.
You've been both complimented and criticized for using a lot of your own personal life in your novels, which I find strange because if you're not going to use your own life, what are you going to use? This book, the main character is a writer. He's a psychiatrist, but he's also a writer. He's Pakistani, and your family, half of your family is Pakistani. So there are connections here. Why do you think you're singled out for writing autobiographical novels when others who do the same thing aren't?
Well, I think the notion of autobiography is a very complicated one because our dreams are autobiographical, our wishes, fantasies. What I'm really interested in is the contemporary. And I've always written about the world in which I've grown up in. And I guess, insofar as my work is autobiographical, it's really to do with the fact that my father's journey as an immigrant from India to Britain in the late 40s, early 50s, became a kind of paradigm of the way Britain changed. So he marries my mother, a white English Christian, and he has his kids, and there's a lot of racism in the 60s. Heavy racism on the street, a lot of skinheads around, and some of that I wrote about in My Beautiful Laundrette, and also, I guess, in The Buddha of Suburbia. So I began to see that my father's journey was not only of interest to me because of him, but because it was a paradigm of kind of the way Britain and Europe was then changing. And then, therefore, subjects like, I don't know, liberalism, integration, assimilation, racism, victimization, all that stuff, I found was not only interesting to me abstractly, but because my family had somehow gone through that. And these new stories, which really emerged in the 80s, I guess, with My Beautiful Laundrette and also with Rushdie's Midnight's Children, kind of opened the door then to other writers like Monica Ali and Zadie Smith. And, you know, there's tons of writers in Canada, United States and Australia from some kind of Indian or colonial background. And post-colonialism has become a big deal. So to finally kind of answer your question, if my work is autobiographical, I guess it's because in some sense my own history and my family's history is kind of intersected with some of the things that are going on.
Well, why do you think that members of your family have publicly mentioned this? I mean, it's not, to me, every character is an amalgam of different characters.
Families are always fighting about who has the right to tell the story in the family. Philip Roth says if there's a writer in that family, the family is dead. And, of course, you'll find in any family, with the siblings particularly, you know, that they're fighting over the parent's body. They're fighting over who has the right to tell the story. And these are fascinating conflicts because you think, well, what really happened? Did anything really happen? You know, there are just versions and versions and versions of stories. And everybody wants to be heard. And in that sense, it kind of explains why there are so many people these days who want to be writers. There are more writers than there are readers these days.
Well, it seems like some people seem to not understand the difference between memoir and fiction anyway. That gets blurred.
Well, it is a blur. I mean, when you think about the past or you tell someone, a friend of yours, a story, there is always a certain amount of what they call enhancement. It's not as though we could ever find out what really happened and tell a straight story about that. It wouldn't be interesting.
Hanif Qureshi, this book, Something to Tell You, the main character is a psychiatrist.
Well, he's not a psychiatrist, actually. He's a psychoanalyst. A psychiatrist is a guy who wears a white coat. And a psychiatrist will, you know, put electricity into your temples and he will probably give you drugs. What's odd about psychoanalysts is, and what's completely different about psychoanalysts and other forms of psychotherapists is, that they actually listen to you. And Freud started doing this very, very weird thing at the end of the 19th century, through the beginning of the 20th century, which was that he actually listened to the mad. And it never occurred to anybody before to listen to the mad. The mad were kind of subjects. They were just medicalized. And I got a lot of friends who are psychoanalysts. And I'm really interested in them. They say, I had a guy in today, and he told me this dream, and he told me this story, and da-da-da. And it's really fascinating to me how weird and strange and odd the unconscious is.
You've been psychoanalyzed for the past 2 decades, though, right?
If I hadn't been, I would be naked running down the street waving an axe, you know? And I'm fascinated by analysis, but a lot of artists are very resistant to it. They think it's going to take away their talent.
The book, in the New York Times, you described this book as a critique of the notion of limitless pleasure. If the society doesn't install values in you, you have to install your own moral values. It seemed to me that while this is true, it's only a small portion of what the novel is.
I like to think that this novel is a comedy, a human comedy. You know, that these people are wicked. They're strange, they're weird, they're in love with each other, and they hate each other. Over quite a period of time, it begins in the mid-70s, where most of my stories begin, where my life, in a way, began as a student. And it moves through the 70s, 80s, up until, really, until the bombings in London in 2005, 7-7, we call it. So it's quite panoramic, quite a big book. And I tell you, man, it nearly killed me to write it. It was a lot of work. Integrating all those characters, those scenes, the whole structure, it was a nightmare to do, but I'm glad to have done it.
But the idea that the focus is on the nature of what we have to perceive as morality also comes back to other things you've said about how in fundamentalism they tell you what morality is, whereas in modern society, in the West, we have to find it for ourselves.
Well, there are two fantasies here, yeah. One's the fantasy of the closed society, say in Marxism, and certainly in religious societies where, you know, obedience, and Islam means obedience, but obviously this also is the case in Christian societies where, you know, there are commandments and forms of behavior that you have to absolutely follow. And then there is a consumer capitalism of the West, which is really to do with freedom and choice and so on. And there are difficulties on both sides. In a closed society, you're really held. You're really contained by that closeness. And in the open society, you have more choice. Therefore, you have more conflict. There's nothing worse than going into a supermarket. You just want to collapse. You think, I don't know what to choose. How am I going to choose? How am I going to make a decision? Who am I? What do I want to wear today? Who do I want to be? So I'm interested in both of those fantasies.
And they intersect in England in 2005 and here in America in 2001. What's interesting to me is that there's a tendency here, because of the bombings and because of right-wing propaganda, to see things in terms of black and white, but it isn't.
Well, these two ideologies, these two fantasies, one of freedom and the other, I guess, of ideological closeness, also produce each other, too. Many Muslims have fantasies about the West which are completely untrue, i.e. it's just a vertigo of mad drug-taking, sex-having consumer madness, whereas you and I know respectability is, don't we? And on the other hand, we have fantasies about Islam and Muslims, which are also pretty crazy. I mean, most of the Muslims that I know, you know, want exactly the same things that you and I want. They want to go shopping, they want good schools, they want hospitals, and they want jobs. So one of the ways in which these two fantasies can be, I guess, broken up is by a good dose of reality. It's by people talking to one another, knowing one another, and writing stories for one another, which I guess is one of the things I try and do.
In 2005, in the London bombings, which comes at the tail end of Something to Tell You, the reaction of Jamal to this, it almost seemed without affect, as if How am I supposed to respond to it?
Well, I think there was a big numbness in Britain after the bombings, partly because these were British kids who blew up these tube trains and the bus in Tavistock Square. And the other thing was that, you know, we'd been fighting a war in Iraq, and it was as though we believed you could fight wars in other countries, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and kill, you know, hundreds of thousands of citizens there. And it wouldn't make any difference to us, to our lives. We could carry on living and shopping. And suddenly, somehow, the war seemed to come home in some way. And then we didn't know what to think. It was odd how little protest. There was some protest. How little protest there was against those two wars. And how, in a way, numb and affectless, as you put it cleverly, as a society we become. When I think, you know, my childhood was inflected, like yours probably, by the Vietnam War, by opposition to that war. And now it seems as though we can fight wars in faraway places as though they were nothing to do with us. They may or may not be good wars, but it's we often try and live as though somehow they were totally beyond us.
There has to be, I think, in all of your writing, there has to be, whether you know, as long as you're going to write about multiculturalism, there has to be a political sense to it. You can't escape it. And because of that, it becomes a different kind of exploration.
Well, there are some writers, many writers that I grew up with who I admire and who are great writers. I'm thinking of someone like Kafka, Beckett. You know, they don't write about the cars people drive or the clothes they wear or whether they had earrings and wore velvet trousers. You know, their work is kind of abstract, modernistic, and so on. But there are other kinds of writers who kind of describe the bars and pubs and the newspapers and stuff. And I kind of like that too. There's a writer who I like called Patrick Hamilton, British writer, good writer, wrote a wonderful book called Hangover Square, I think set in 1939. And it's about pubs in London. And it gives you a fantastic sense of these bars and pubs. And I guess I would like to be, I guess, that kind of writer, partly a journalistic writer. You tell people what your world is like and what it was like on that day. You know, and so if I write about Blair, I know that in 5 years' time, people are going to read this book, and they, you know, why, you know, who's going to be interested in Tony Blair 5 years ago, or Clinton, you know. But I like writing that's kind of reporting, too.
Hanif Qureshi, this book also contains characters from other works of yours. One of the characters, and it's more than a cameo, is Omar from My Beautiful Laundrette. You also have Charlie Hero from Boot Up Suburbia. What were you doing there?
Well, you know, sometimes I sit in my room and I think, what am I doing with my life? And I think one of the things I've done with my life is make up people. You know, I made up these characters. And there's Kareem Amir from The Boot Up Suburbia, Charlie Hero, and as you say, Omar Ali from My Beautiful Laundrette. And I think, how are they doing? You know, what are they doing now? Just as one might think about one's old friends, what are they doing? They're part of my life. I made them. And one of the things that's interesting is, you know, you make friends with people when you're a student, when you're 19, and then when you're 55, you still know them. And they got kids, they got divorced, their parents have died. And I'm fascinated by, you know, change and continuity through time.
You also have characters who are real people, like Mick Jagger.
Yeah, it amused me very much to have Mick Jagger in this book.
Do you know Mick?
I met him one time, and when I met him, I put him in the story. The Stones were a huge thing for me, you know, ever since I was a little kid, really. You know, the Stones and the Beatles were massive in my life. And then one day I meet Mick Jagger for, you know, an hour, that's all. And we, you know, talk about private schools in West London. And that's the end of our debate. And it seemed very amusing to me that this rock god, you know, is fascinated by private schools in West London. And in fact, two of my kids go to the same school as his, you know, how are the teachers, you know, one of the uniforms like. And it just seemed funny to me, so I put it in the book.
And actually had him recommend the school to Jamal for his son.
Yeah. There's no better person to ask about good schools.
The book also has some very, very raunchy sexual scenes taking place in a sex club. Are you familiar with the sex clubs of London?
I was about to become familiar with the sex clubs of London. And I was always saying to my wife, listen, I've got to go and do this research. You know, I want to write about this stuff because I'm interested in the sexual revolution, which I guess I lived through. But I don't like going out late at night because my kids wake up early and I get their breakfast, get them to school. So what I did was I wrote all the scenes, and then I thought, well, then I'll go and do the research and put the stuff in later. But in the end, I never got round to doing the research. I didn't bother with that. I just made it up. Sometimes writers make up things, you know.
Has anybody questioned you on it? Or?
Well, it's not really like that, or it is like that. No, they haven't, actually. No. I mean, people say my work is autobiographical, but they can never tell the bits that actually did and didn't happen. It doesn't seem to make much difference. It's just a story, man.
This is about the sexual revolution. Where do you think we're going with that? I mean, AIDS came in and kind of transformed everything. Is there a move back? What if they find a cure for AIDS in the next 2 years, which is possible?
Well, once we got sexually liberated, I guess, after the 40s and 50s, and for most people the 60s actually was a very uptight time, apart from, you know, 20 people in London who were having a good time. Then we have to think really about what else it is that people need from each other. They don't only want to copulate, they want to be recognized, they want to talk, they want tenderness, they want relationships. And I think people are much more interested in that now than they are only about copulation.
You're listening to an interview with Hanif Qureshi, whose latest book is Something to Tell You. You've written several screenplays, and you actually directed a film yourself, London Kills Me. What do you think in terms of plotting, in terms of organization, in terms of editing? How do you think the fact that you've done screenplays works in terms of working in a novel? Do you think they're totally separate, or do you think there's a relationship?
I think that's an interesting question. I think about that because I teach writing, you know, and most of the students, what really bothers them is exactly what you're talking about, which is the architecture of the writing. How the hell do you get this material in the right order, you know? And certainly movies do teach you a lot about that. I mean, a movie's got to be tight, and it's got to move forward all the time. Books can spoil a bit, and you can put anything in a book, but still a book's got to have a shape and a structure. What you've got to do is distribute the information at the right time in the right way. It's like a strip show. You know, you don't take everything off, and that's it. You know, you've got to take it off at the right time in the right order. And it's very hard to do, and there's no easy answer. You just sit down for ages, and you move this stuff around. But I learned a lot from working with movie directors. I work with Stephen Frears, I work with Roger Michel, and so on. And they go, take that scene out, move it earlier. Can't you see that they don't need to know that now? Because those guys have a really good instinct. They got to, you know, this material is going to be on a huge screen in front of 1,000 people. You know, it's got to hold up. And I learned a lot from working with other people.
Do you think it's instinctive now? I mean, were there, in Something to Tell You, are there outtakes that you felt had to come out that still exist?
Well, you get better as a writer. But it's still hard, and it's got to be hard. I mean, there's no point sitting down writing a book that's really easy to write. It's totally pointless. You know, you want there to be challenges. Otherwise, there's no friction. There's nothing alive in there. So it's always a struggle.
Well, when you sat down and began actually writing the book, how much of the book was charted out? In other words, how much is plot-driven, how much is character-driven?
I had the beginning of this story. This story really starts in the 70s, and it's about a love affair between a boy and a girl. And then a very bad thing happens.
Right.
And this very bad thing, you know, influences the rest of the book. I had all that. And then it took me ages, just to years, in fact, to get the rest of the stuff that went around it. I had to keep making decisions about, do I want to write about the 80s? How am I going to get the 80s into a book that starts in the 70s? Do I want to write about 2005? How do I get that into the story? It's got to be weaved in all the way through and so on.
What frequently happens when I've talked to other writers is that certain characters they thought were minor. I don't want to say the characters take over the book because you're actually in control, but on some level, it feels as if characters that you thought were minor or major and vice versa. Did that happen in this book?
Yeah, I mean, there are two characters, Henry, the best friend of the hero, and his sister Miriam, who are really fun for me to write, and they're quite kind of mad, extreme characters. You know, she's tattooed and pierced and goes to sex clubs. He's a very distinguished theater director who does movies and so on. Talks a lot, is crazy and wild. And I felt very uninhibited writing those characters, because in a sense they're not like me. You couldn't be further away from me, you know. Do they take over? Well, they develop. And then you think, oh, wouldn't it be great if they did that? And wow, what happened if that happened? You know, it's the pleasure in writing that the reader picks up in reading.
Did you know that the rock star later on in the book was the same character as the boy who comes on to Jamal?
No. I mean, there was this kid. He was the brother. He comes on to Jamal when he's, I don't know, 13, 14 years old. And later he turns up introduced to Jamal again by Mick Jagger. You know, it occurred to me one day that that was a good idea. You know, I didn't know that until it occurred to me. And that's what's fun about writing.
What's the difference between working on a book like Something to Tell You or screenplays like My Beautiful Laundrette or even Sammy and Rosie Get Laid versus working on something like Venus, which seems to take place in a completely alternate universe where you're dealing with some elderly people in a theater milieu?
Venus was really fun to write because there's these two old guys played by Leslie Phillips and Peter O'Toole. And I really liked writing their dialogue. Once I could hear their voices, you know, hello, boy, how are you doing? All right.
You knew they were in it even when you were writing?
No, I didn't know until later on. I mean, okay. You write a draft of the script, then you meet with the director, and then you begin to talk about, wouldn't it be great if Peter O'Toole played this part? And then you can hear Peter O'Toole talking, and then you think, oh, I'll bring in this young girl, you know. She's what we call in England kind of slang, an uncouth girl. You know, and it seemed funny, as you say, it might seem like a kind of alternate universe to you, but it was really good fun to do.
Did you get a chance to spend any time with O'Toole?
Yeah, I did. We were terrified of him, me and the director. We were terrified. You know, he's a big movie star, and he's been a big movie star for a long time. And we were really scared of him, you know. But actually, he was decent. When we went through the script together, you know, he said, I want to change that, and I think that and that, two or three things. And then he stuck to the script. You know, there's no messing about. He did, you know, what he was told. He behaved well, and, you know, it was terrific.
For a movie like My Beautiful Laundrette, did you have that kind of input because it was your first screenplay?
Stephen Frears, who directed that film and who is indeed a good mate of mine, works very closely with the writers. And he didn't know that world, really, of Asians in London. But he was interested. He wanted to learn about it. So, you know, I was on the set with him, and he would say, would they do that? Do they say that? Is that right? You know, he had to know, had to have me around.
That was Daniel Day-Lewis's first film or first major role. Did you think that this guy would wind up being, you know, one of our greatest actors? Was it apparent to you at that point?
Daniel Day-Lewis always had, and still has, incredible charisma. And I used to hang around with him when we were doing the film. He lived near me, and we used to go to bars and stuff. And it was a kind of nightmare to go out with him because he was so, and indeed is, but even then he was so beautiful and stunning and tall and had incredible hair and cheekbones. And people would just come up to me all the time. Chicks would come up to me all the time and say, would you introduce me to your friend? He used to drive me crazy, you know. He's an extraordinary looking guy with a, you know, magnificent face. Very, very tall and impressive guy. So it was kind of a nightmare. He used to come around to my house to watch Scorsese pictures because he didn't have a TV. So he used to come around and watch Mean Streets and other early Scorsese films. It's funny, he ended up later on working with Scorsese.
Did he ever talk about acting technique with you?
No, man, we never talk about that. Writers never talk about that with each other. The only time I ever talk about work is when I'm teaching. Actually, I don't think actors ever talk about technique in a way.
Did he ever talk about his dad?
Yeah, he did a bit. Because he plays a working-class character. And Stephen Frears and I used to say, you know, maybe we should cast Gary Oldman in this part, you know, because, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis is really posh. You know, he's much posher than us. His father was the poet laureate. And Dan loves literature and knows a bit about literature.
Hanif Qureshi, when you're working on a novel, do you ever think in terms of themes before you begin, or do you think that they just gradually emerge and maybe aren't even visible to you until after you finish the book?
Well, I'm thinking about stuff, you know, as you're thinking about stuff all the time, various things. But I'm thinking about it in a kind of, you know, unconscious way. I don't even know that I'm thinking about it. Maybe I'm thinking about sexuality, I'm thinking about aging, I'm thinking about marriage, about divorce, about kids. You know, it's all going on. And then I begin to write, I find a character. Then the character begins to speak for me, begins to express my ideas. Then I find another character who expresses other ideas, and then somehow I put them together. There's a conflict, and then there's a story.
You've also written plays. How do you think the work on plays falls between working on a screenplay and working on a novel? And also, let's throw in short stories here.
Well, I love the theater. I like working in the theater. I mean, it's more fun in a way working in the theater than it is on movies, because you're not with a room full of people. When you're on a set on a movie set, so many people there. And you're rehearsing a play, there's, you know, the actors and the director, and that's that. There's a kind of intensity about it. It's really fun to do, but I never made much money out of that, so I turned to the movies. Short stories are wonderful to write, and I love writing stories, and I still write stories. I've got loads of stories on my computer I'm working on. You know, you can just take a little idea and throw it off. But on the other hand, you don't make any money out of that either. I mean, I'm a hustler. I'm trying to make a living at this.
We're now post-Blair, and we may even see the reemergence of the Tories. Where do you see England going at this point? I mean, there was a period, certainly, you know, early Blair was a reaction to Thatcherism, and Blair in his early days was almost Clintonian until he became, Bush's pet dog. Where do you think see England now?
I have to say, first of all, it's much more interesting to be in America. It's really, this is a good time for me to be in America. It's really riveting to see the glamour, intelligence, and beauty of a black American man who may become president. And on the other hand, this other woman, Sarah Palin, I guess, who represents another part of America. And it seems to me there's a real struggle going on for the soul of your country between these two elements, actually. England's more depressing in a way. It's not as interesting. It's not exciting because we're about to hit a recession. And it looks to me as though the Tories are going to come round again. But at the same time, there's going to be, you know, big unemployment. A lot of people are going to lose their houses. Marx said a long time ago that capitalism booms and then busts. People seem to have forgotten that. So it's much darker, the picture in Britain. And I think there's a kind of optimism in America, particularly if Obama comes through, which is very thrilling for us and the rest of the world, because you've had a bad luck with the presidents recently.
There's a great deal of contempt toward Blair expressed in Something to Tell You.
Blair was a big deal for our generation because he was around our age, you know. He was a kind of 68er. And he was doing fine. And then, as you say, he hooked up with Bush, supported the war in Iraq, didn't offer any, as it were, alternative ideas of how the world could combat terrorism, made a real mess as a friend of Bush in Afghanistan and Iraq, didn't help the people there a great deal. And a lot of us became, as I guess you do, rather disillusioned and rather bitter. And, of course, one of the other things that's happened in Britain is that the divide between the rich and the poor has got bigger. I mean, one of the things we've always wanted, is for a society that's much more equal and in which people have opportunities. And Blair really failed in that sense. And it's been a disgrace and disappointment to my generation.
There's a sequence, a brief sequence in Something to Tell You, where these people from this posh party go out clubbing and they're treated with hate by the locals.
Yeah, that's right. It's a kind of class attack. There's these rich rock kids living in a big house. And then down the road, you know, there are white working class, drug-riddled communities, unemployed, mostly badly educated, living in bad housing. And they're bitter because we've lived through a time, as you have in the U.S., of huge increase of wealth and people got rich and so on. Not everybody got rich. And there hasn't been a proper distribution. And it seems to me we've forgotten about ideals and the ideals of the 60s to do with equality.
It seems kind of sad that Omar, the character in My Beautiful Laundrette, who is perfectly willing to cross the line in terms of class, has forgotten all of that.
Well, Omar from My Beautiful Laundrette, he was an entrepreneur. He opened a laundrette and he ran it as you and I would with Daniel Day-Lewis. And the point of My Beautiful Laundrette, I guess, was partly it was a satire on entrepreneurialism. You know, whether you are black or Irish or Indian or Chinese or whatever, you too could make it big. And he's made it big. And when you make it big, you forget those who can't. And his story is one of the stories of our time.
There is, again, in Something to Tell You, there is that element of class that pops up, not a whole lot, but it does pop up every now and then. Jamal is not quite upper class in Pakistan when he goes back. I mean, his family's educated, but he's not upper class. And he comes back, and he's not wealthy, I don't think, but he's hanging out with wealthy people. So there are dichotomies that occur in Something to Tell You. Do you see that in your own life?
I guess so. I come from the suburbs. And I grew up in a kind of bubble I can see now. After the war, free health, totally free education I had, paid for by the state, you know. My father was a civil servant. He didn't have any money, and my mother was a housewife. Free everything. And I was a lucky kid. And I got through. I got educated. I went to work in the theaters, which were all subsidized by the state to And then I worked at the BBC. I worked at the National Theatre, etc., etc. These are all institutions run by the state. And a kid like me, a brown kid from the suburbs, wasn't going to get into England in through any other route. And I'm kind of nervous that a lot of those routes now are blocked for young people, and that's what concerns me the most.
According to IMDb, you have a screenplay for a movie that's supposed to come out called Weddings and Beheadings.
Weddings and Beheadings is a short. Okay. It's a 10-minute film set in somewhere like Iraq about a kid who wants to be a movie maker. And his job, he gets dragged in by these bad guys because he can make videos to video beheadings. You probably remember a few years ago there were a spate of beheadings that were always on the internet and shown on Al Jazeera and so on. And I remember seeing bits of these and thinking, who was the guy who videoed these? You know, maybe there was some little kid who they got him in because he knew how to operate the camera. And it seemed like a funny idea. Funny, I mean, ironic and dark, strange idea. This kid has to do this because he can operate the camera. So I wrote a short story based on it called Weddings and Beheadings. And there was a little movie. It was banned by the BBC, actually, because it was thought to be too, you know, crude and violent. But it was a satire on how ordinary people get dragged into wars.
Did you direct it?
It was directed by a friend of mine, Amir Jamal. You wouldn't want me directing things. I'm not really a director.
Well, you directed that one movie, London Kills Me.
Yeah, I did direct a movie. But I would say that I'm probably not a director.
And you don't plan on doing that again?
I like directors. I admire what they do, you know, like in the way that I admire actors. But I couldn't do it.
And apparently you're working on two different screenplays now?
I've done a screenplay for my novel, The Black Album, which is about a young kid who kind of gets dragged into something like Muslim fundamentalism in the early 90s and they end up burning the Satanic Verses. I'm also trying to write a movie with my pal, Roger Michel, set in Paris. But, you know, writing movies is just the beginning. It's getting the money together is a big deal.
And Something to Tell You has come out. Have you begun thinking about your next novel?
I don't know if I write another novel. I always say that. I finish this novel, I finish this movie, I'm never going to do another one, you know. I've had it. It's too hard. It's too this, it's too that.
Well, what happens? What changes? What happens? Is there suddenly you need money or suddenly just a bug comes into your head?
Yeah, you get a little idea. And then you think, oh, that's not a bad idea. And then it gets to be a bigger idea. And you think, no, I wish that idea would go away. It's a crap idea. And then the idea stays with you and eventually you're writing another damn book.
But what happened with Something to Tell You?
Same kind of thing.
What was that germ, that little idea? You remember?
It was really about two people falling in love, not seeing each other again, and then meeting 30 years later, and really wondering about what happened in between and wondering whether anything could happen between them again.
And at what point do you go, wait, there's a novel, or there's a short story, or a screenplay, or, I mean, how does that follow?
The story normally tells me.
Really?
But I'll think around it. It'll tell me because the characters are talking. If they're talking, then it's a movie. If I can see the description and it's set over a long period of time, it's a novel. And if I can do it in a week, it's a short story.
In this case, you began seeing descriptions.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to write about the streets where I live. I wanted to write about the cafes. I wanted to write about the waiters and the waitresses. Then I wanted to write about rich people's houses. Then I wanted to write about poor people's houses. You know, and you can do that in a novel in a way you probably can't in a movie.
Hanif Qureshi, your work seems to deal with class culture. It's clearly literature rather than just pop culture. Yet you don't have a problem incorporating pop culture into your work, and you've said you like pop culture. Should we be less interested in dividing culture into pop and art?
When I listen to Otis Redding, or Billie Holiday, or Miles Davis, or Smokey Robinson, or Jimi Hendrix, you know, it seems to me that this is the greatest music that's been made. That these are really great artists who speak to me, just as when I listen to Brahms or I listen to Schubert. So I wouldn't have contempt for any of that stuff at all. It's deeply moving, listening to Otis Redding, particularly, you know. So why do we worry about these divisions and worry so much about what is what? I mean, we used to a lot, you know. People used to say, can you remember that people used to say, are movies really art? And then you think of Fellini and Bergman and Antonioni and The Simpsons. These are all forms of human expression, and they all give pleasure, and they all have meaning, and that seems to me to be a very deep human thing.
You've been listening to an interview with Hanif Qureshi, whose latest novel is Something to Tell You. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.